All right, I'm calling this meeting of the House Special Energy Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 17th, and the time when I hit the gavel was 10:16 a.m. We're joined by Representative Carrick, Representative Shragi, Representative McKay, Representative Wright, and myself. I'm Chair Rauscher. In the room, I don't see any other representatives or senators to make note of. But I would like to thank our House Recording Secretary, Jordan Wright, and our LIO moderator, Kelsey Riker. Is that the way I pronounce it correctly? Kelsey Riker. For all they do for this committee. Before we begin, I'd like to remind the members of the committee and the people in the room, if you'd like to please silence your cell phones and other personal electronics. We will see a film strip later on, so I'm going to ask that everybody holds their questions till the end of each slide. And I'm not sure how many slides there will be at this point. But today before, oh yeah, and if you have any questions, please direct them through the chair to the testifiers. And today I plan to bring before us HB 74, Geothermal Resources. It's my intention to pass this out of committee. And so, and then after that, we will hear the presentation from Merrick Jakinski of ORPC regarding the in-river power generation. Mr. Jakinski will be with us over Teams, by the way. That's probably him right there, that MJ. So, all right, getting back to 74, having heard public testimony on HB 74 last week, are there any additional questions from committee members? Representative Carrick.
Thank you to the chair. I did just send a few questions into DNR, mm-hmm. and I'm not expecting answers for them today because I was late on sending them, and as I mentioned prior to the start of this meeting, it doesn't necessarily impact my decision-making on the legislation before the committee, but I am curious about the current tax structure for geothermal energy and the current revenue the state receives from geothermal energy, and also curious about the penalties section and the acreage size increase that's in this legislation. And just a little bit more information on how the permit structure that we currently use is utilized with the lease structure in this legislation, and whether a permit for exploration becomes a lease for exploration. So those were some of the questions I had. I'm curious if other members of the committee or the chair would like those responses as well when I receive them back. If that would be of interest, I'm happy to share them.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Do you have them all written down, right?
I do.
Joe, is anybody from the DNR here to be able to answer these questions online? Okay. Who do we have?
Should be.
I don't see anybody here. Okay. All right. So thank you for getting that on the screen. So online with us, we have Haley Payne, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas. We also have Aaron O'Quinn, Division of Oil and Gas, Department of Natural Resources. We have Brett Huber, Commissioner, Oil and Gas Conservation. And so were any of the three people online able to hear Representative Carrick's questions? If not, I can have them repeated. And does anybody want to take a stab at answering those? And please, if you do, put your name and affiliation on the record before you do it. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, Chair Rauscher. This is Aaron O'Quinn from the Division of Oil and Gas. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Great. Yes, I was able to hear Representative Carrick's questions, and I'll just take a stab at them in the order that I have them written down. That's not necessarily the order she asked them. If if that's okay with you.
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. Well, so we'll get started with the question between kind of the question regarding the permit structure and basically what's changing. So currently we have an exploration permit regime that authorizes a 2-year exploration period in which someone who's been issued that permit has to find a commercial quantity of geothermal energy. What we're doing is we're changing the name from a permit to a license. So instead of a prospecting permit, they're going to have a prospecting license. So it's merely a name change there to kind of bring it into conformance to the way we describe other types of surface versus subsurface authorizations in the Department of Natural Resources. We're changing the term from 2 years, which is the current allowed time period to find that commercial resource, to a 5-year period. And then we're changing the requirements from finding a commercial quantity to expending a certain amount of dollars toward in work commitment. So instead of having to find something, they just have to spend a certain amount of money. And then instead of doing that within that 2-year period, we're giving them 5 years to do that. So that's the change. At the end of, you know, either in the first instance or in the new proposed structure under the bill, they'll then be issued a lease. So that lease is then good for an additional period of time, 10 years. And during that period of time, they can continue to explore and develop that resource, build out their infrastructure, that sort of thing. So that's basically the difference. The current permits that have been issued, we do have a provision in the bill that allows those permittees to seek to convert those permits to a new license structure that we're proposing under the bill. And so I hope that answers the question. Representative Carrick, through the chair, is there any clarification there if needed?
Just a quick follow-up on that.
Follow-up.
Thank you, through the chair. I really appreciate this. Does a permit for exploration automatically become a lease for exploration? And you had just said, too, that it's just a name change, but we're extending the timeline from 2 to 5 years. And to me, a permit and a lease are kind of two different things fundamentally. So in terms of the exploration side, could you maybe elaborate a little bit there?
Sure. Representative Carrick, through the chair, just to clarify, we're not changing permit to lease, we're changing permit to license. And so at the end of the permit period, which is our current structure, the applicant can convert their permit to a lease. And at the end of the 5-year period under the proposed exploration license program, they can also convert to a lease. So in both cases, either under the existing or the proposed, they are converting their authorization to a lease at the end of their exploration period. We're changing it from 2 years to 5 years, and then we're changing the requirements of what they actually have to do to get that lease. So in the current status, or the current regime, they have to find a commercial quantity of geothermal energy within that 2-year period. In the proposed license program, they have to expend a defined dollar amount for work commitment within the 5-year period. So in both instances, they convert to a lease. We're just changing it from a 2-year period to a 5-year period, and then we're changing it from a commercial quantity to expenditure of a defined work commitment. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. And to the chair, I actually have a number of questions. I don't want to take up the committee's time too much today on these. I did ask for some responses in writing, and I feel that that's sufficient for me. The one other question I would not mind asking on the record, though, is the current state revenue from geothermal energy. I'm not sure that we really got a good answer on that. So under the current tax structure, what's current state revenue from geothermal?
Representative Carrick, through the chair, there's no current infrastructure. So the taxing regime for geothermal energy would fall under the same tax structure as pretty much any industry. So they would be subject to property taxes. If they're located within a municipality that has taxing authority. And then in addition to that, they might be subject to corporate income tax if they were a qualifying entity and had income. That being said, we do have three existing geothermal exploration permits that have been issued to some of the witnesses who testified before the committee at the last hearing, and those have generated some revenue. So we've got Mount Spur that's generated about $38,000 in rent. We've got two geothermal prospecting permits at Mount Spur that have generated about $93,000 in rent, and then one on Augustine Island that has, so far, it's only been issued for about a year now, has paid the state about $9,300 approximately. So we're looking at roughly about $100,000 over the last 2 to 3 years in revenue from our geothermal authorization under the permitting regime.
Okay, great. Thank you. I appreciate the chair's indulgence in the responses and would look forward to getting responses to some of the other questions I sent in writing back.
Representative Carrick, this is going to go to resources next. And I believe if you want to have them in your office to spend some time, I'm sure they would indulge you. And there's plenty of opportunity there for you to, before this ever gets to the floor, for you to arrange some time with them and go over the parts that are of concern to you. And I appreciate all the questions that you are asking, and I hope that'll be fine. Will that work for you? Good. Thank you. Any more questions from the committee? All right. Do I hear a motion there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Rep. McKay. For the record, I move House Bill 74, Work Order 33-GH-1618-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Do I hear any objections? All right, hearing no objections, seeing none, the House Bill 74 moves to committee. We will take a break at ease to complete the paperwork and transition to our presentation. Brief at ease. Back on record, we have a motion withdrawal here. Representative McKay.
Yes, for the record, this is Representative McKay. Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my previous motion regarding House Bill 74.
I appreciate that. Any objections? Withdrawing the motion. Do you have another? Okay, let's just go this way. What is the will of the committee now?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, this is Rep. McKay, Representative McKay. I move House Bill 74, Work Order 33-GH-1618-A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Do I hear any objections?
Just a quick objection for clarification.
Certainly.
I believe there's just one fiscal note. Is that correct?
I believe there were two, but let me look
here.
There was a zero, and then that one was from my request. Let's see, Department of Commerce, and then there's a second one. And that one's for 180 in 2024, zero, and then 2025 would be 160, and then on until 2029.
Thank you, Chair Rauscher. I withdraw my objection.
You bet. Okay. Any more objections to the motion? All right. So moved, and everybody hang tight so we can sign the book, and it will leave committee. Okay, we are back on record. Next, we're going to hear from Mr. Jakinski of ORPC. Mr. Jakinski, if you would, if you can hear us, can you put yourself on record and give us your name, and then you may begin.
Certainly. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
All right, great. My name is Merrick Jakinski. I'm the Director of Development for ORPC here in Alaska. Thank you, Chair Rauscher, for inviting me to speak at this special hearing. And we'll go ahead and get started. I'm assuming you guys have the slides in your room available there for you?
Yes, we do.
Great. We can go ahead and proceed to the next slide then. Just as a brief overview, I'm going to talk about who ORPC is, kind of what we're doing in Alaska, who I am and what my background is, and then also be speaking about some of the remote opportunities for communities in Alaska, and lastly, where we're going with tidal power with the state of Alaska and kind of what the industry trends are there. Next slide, please. We'd actually go down two slides. So a bit on myself. I'm a born and raised Alaskan from the Inukshuk area, or the Inukshuk Native Association tribe there. I have a dual degree in aerospace and mechanical engineering, and my work background runs the gamut from commercial and sport fishing to construction management, sales managing, contract negotiation, and things like that. So in the private industry here in Alaska is kind of where I cut my teeth. I currently work in the Anchorage area, and I've been with ORPC since January 2020, and looking forward to advancing the company and the state here. Next slide, please. ORPC's been around since 2007. They're based in Portland, Maine, so they are an East Coast-based company. We have offices in Ireland, Chile, and Canada as well. And the main core technology for ORPC is based on converting moving flowing water into electrical energy to be used for renewable solution. ORPC sees that our technology is a great fit with remote communities, for some critical infrastructure. And we're also hoping to leverage some of that to create some local jobs here and create that workforce around it. Next slide, please. ORPC has four product pipelines that we're working with. The first three, which is the RibGen, the modular RibGen, and the TideGen, all use a similar componentry called the turbine generator unit. So those systems are very repeatable, replicatable, and that's a common system for us to work with, so we don't have to have excess training for systems. The RibGen system, which is on the far left, is what we have installed in Alaska in Igiagig. We also have this system installed in Manitoba, Canada, and we have an upcoming installation in Chile Chico and Patagonia area. Next, we have our modular RibGen system, which is kind of designed for more of like a low water type application. The system uses the same course technology and is located currently in Millinocket, Maine for a demonstration project. Our next system is our TideGen system, which is focused on more of a tidal location rather than a river location. The system is going through its development process right now. We have a demonstration deployment coming up here at the end of April, I believe is when it is, slated for at the moment. And that system is hopefully going to be coming up to Cook Inlet in Alaska this year as well. And then lastly, our grid penetration and large population area size systems, what we call the Optimore, which is for the megawatt scale system. This is currently under development in Ireland through some grants and research through the United Kingdom. Next slide, please. So as a quick snapshot as to where ORPC has our footprint, this is kind of a nice way to see things. We do have a second deployment of a RibGen coming up in Alaska this summer. Of course, I mentioned our device in Manitoba, Canada, and our deployment in Maine and in Chile Chico. And then we also have our TideGen test systems that are going in some of the European countries as well as in Maine as well. We've had interest from over 48 countries. Depending on the level of effort here is kind of how we scaled this map. So it's very interesting to see where some of these locations are located. Next slide, please. I just brought this in here just to kind of show that we're breaking into a commercialization aspect. ORPC has been working on DOE contracts for a long time, and we are now growing into this commercial aspect of a business partner. We recently received a $25 million growth capital investment round led by Canadian Shield, which is the investment arm of Hatch, which is a global engineering company. And they see this as a good fit. We've been working with them to refine some of our systems and bring them up as an industry player as well with ORPC. Next slide, please. can speak briefly on some of the remote community opportunities that we have. This is heavily focused on Alaska and some of the markets that are more relevant to what we see every day here in the state. Next slide, please. What ORPC's goal is to create this standard application where we have both a RidGen power system, some kind of smart diesel microgrid controller, also a battery energy storage system to provide this baseload energy for remote communities. We're doing this right now in Ikiyagig. We actually have most of these components installed. We'll be installing our second RivGen turbine this year in the water. So they'll have everything that's in that little blue box kind of set up for themselves. What this allows is an expansion of grid capabilities. So the diesels aren't strained in their capacity and can actually bring on more facilities and more electricity. Most communities in Alaska use about a fourth of the electricity that the average railboat user uses. So this is an opportunity we see to kind of bring some of those villages up and have some more electrical production in their areas. This also allows us the ability to kind of hook in with other renewables such as wind or solar through the implementation of this smart energy storage system. One of the difficulties with renewables in any facet is that they are unpredictable by nature. So we don't know exactly what day is going to be windy. We don't know exactly what day is going to be sunny. But the nice thing about river power and tidal power is that the rivers are always flowing and the tide is always moving. So we can use that as a baseload case. And that's where this battery energy storage system comes into place. Next slide, please. When you look at how diesel communities have their pricing set, and of course this does not take into case the PCE credit here in Alaska, but our system is actually competitive with some of these higher diesel rates. So a diesel-powered grid is anywhere from 25 cents to 58 cents, depending on the install cost and capacity, where we see our system is fitting in a best-fit curve within those prices. So it's very interesting and compelling argument as to why some of these systems could actually work in remote communities as well. We do foresee that, of course, with the incidents that are happening with Ukraine, that diesel prices are likely to continue to rise for a little while. And this is kind of a more interesting case for this scenario. Next slide, please. In Ikiyagig, we have the systems that are shown here. Briefly show those in some of the diagrammatical pictures earlier, but these are the real-world systems. The device on the bottom left is the RivGen system, and that is actually, in this image, it is up for maintenance. When the system is deployed, it is actually sunk completely underwater, so you don't see the system at all. You can see it if you fly over it with the plane or things like that, but on the surface of the water, it's not there. It's able to have boats driven over the top of it. There's still commercial fishing activities. There are sport fishing activities that happen around it as well. And then that system hooks into that white box, which is the Schneider Energy battery system. And that has recently gone through its commissioning steps. Our next step this summer, of course, is to install a second RivGen unit. The first one was previously pulled out as part of a DOE contract. That system will be going back in the water this summer, so they'll be back up to 100% capacity for these two RivGen systems. Next slide, please. One of the big questions that we get a lot is how our system impacts the environment and what it does with salmon. We've gone through quite a bit of monitoring in this aspect and have seen no negative impacts on the environment or to the salmon populations to date. We're still going through some research with an adaptive management team to determine effects to the smolt population within the Kwechak River and hope to replicate some of this research in other areas as well. The system also operates through the winter, operates under ice, is able to go through some interesting occurrences such as frazzle ice, where the river really turns into a slushy, and is still able to operate after that. So it's a very harsh environment, but with the way that the system is designed, it's definitely proven itself as one of the most robust options for that river power.
Mr. Jukinski, I was wondering, what's the RPMs on something like that?
This device spins about 60 to 70 RPM, so it's not incredibly fast. It does, it's driven mostly by the tide and the river current right there. So it's you can kind of envision how fast 60 RPM would be, 60 rotations per minute.
And follow up with my understanding is that no matter which way the water is going, that turns one direction only because of the way it's designed. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's why we went with, there's two reasons why ORPC went with this cross-flow turbine design. And I believe if you slip to the next slide, there might be a better image of the turbine to see itself. Yeah, that one there. So the turbine has this helical shape, which allows it to always have a capture face in the flow. So if the tide is coming in a tidal location anyway, the tide is coming, you know, ebb or flood, the system always has a capture face that can capture and utilize that flow. And the advantage of this is that it just allows the turbine to spin in one direction constantly. So there's no reversing, there's no spinning, there's no twisting of the system. It just operates in the same direction every which way it goes. The other nice thing about this kind of shape is that it's low profile, so we can actually be below the ice, below vessel traffic. Don't have to take up some real estate on top of the water. Don't have to deal with waves. We can just be down in that more safe environment for our system locates at. And as we're kind of developing these systems here in Alaska, we want to make sure that we're definitely operating where there's, you know, avoidance of pan ice and things like that as well. So any further questions on that?
Any Chair? Questions? Anybody? All right. Please continue.
Absolutely. And I'll keep in time
for questions. We do have a question from Representative Wright.
Please. Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, how much power does that produce on a yearly basis?
On a yearly basis, I'd have to look again. I probably don't have that number in front of me. the system is rated for the RibGen system, which is in Niigata. That is a 40-kilowatt turbine, so 40 to 80 kilowatts, depending on how fast the river is flowing in that area. So if you extrapolate that out every day, 40 times 24, that could be the amount of kilowatt hours that we produce. And then over the year, we're actually into that kind of that megawatt hour scale for the year. So where these systems shine is in a small grid capacity. So in a lot of Alaskan villages, the grid load is somewhere between 30 to 80 kilowatt hours or kilowatts of instantaneous use. So our system actually matched up quite well with having some reliable grid penetration in those areas. Where these systems don't provide the right level of grid penetration is on a large grid like the rail bike utilities, Juneau, some of those other larger places where they're kind of in the megawatt scale. But that's what our Optimore system is designed for, to have that larger penetration and more reliability into the grid. And I'd be happy to follow up with more information if that's amenable.
All right. Well, please, sir, please continue.
Thank you, Chair. The modular RibGen system that's shown here, this was recently deployed in January. This system is operating in Millinocket, Maine at the end of a paper mill. The system is kind of designed to work with existing infrastructures, so bridges, harbors, these tail races of dams type scenario. We use common components for linking these devices up. They're designed to be able to integrate together side by side, up and down, so you can create sort of a wall effect with the systems instead of rather a sporadic effect. Looking forward to installing some of these here in the coming years, and we have some larger focus projects on in the lower 48 with this system. Next slide, please. Where we're going in Alaska is we're really pushing for some of these Western communities and remote villages in Alaska. We have a partnership with AVEC that we recently have seen award of $1.5 million of congressional directed funding to do some of this hydrokinetic assessment work in the state to determine where appropriate locations for these systems will be. We're very happy to be working with the AVEC on this opportunity. As you know, they are the largest operator of rural grids in the state, having 58 grids in total under themselves. So ultimately what we'd like to do with this is turn some of these locations into actual projects at the end of this, and that's what that project is mostly focused on. Next slide, please. We also have an ongoing project in the city of False Pass, where we are going through the efforts to modernize their microgrid and make it become ready to bring on some of these renewable equipments as well. We recently also received congressional directed funding for False Pass to actually build a system. So we'll be going through that effort this year as well and getting a machine in the water here in the coming years. Next slide, please. And then the big thing, of course, that's on everybody's mind, I think that gets talked about a lot, is Cook Inlet tidal. And we can go to the next slide and I'll kind of tee it off from there. Cook Inlet is known as one of the largest tidal resources in the world, I think only second to the Bay of Fundy. You know, if anybody's been in the Cook Inlet area, you know the tides, they can move 30 feet up and down sometimes. And this creates a tremendous amount of velocity that comes through the area. There's a lot of interest in Cook Inlet, a lot of interest in developing Cook Inlet, and ORBC is right there with it. We have a joint development agreement with Home Electric Association that's been in place with its most current iteration since 2018. We're working to kind of expand on that contract over the coming decade. Next slide, please. ORPC has a four-year FERC preliminary permit for Cook Inlet's East Foreland site. So this is a location right outside of Nikiski, which we see as our first commercial build-out and operation site. We're also having conversations with others that are in the Cook Inlet areas about how we can operate on platforms and how we can kind of maybe bring some ease to use to some of the natural gas concerns in the Cook Inlet area as well, and definitely having those cross-collaboration discussions with other industry players as well. And this is a picture from our site over by what is now Hillcorp's dock location.
Hey, Merrick, I was wondering, is in the inlet, are you anticipating a lot more maintenance than you would in a river because of the particles floating around out there?
That's a good question. So the Cook Inlet environment is definitely a harsh one when it has silt that is naturally inherent to the water itself. And also there's a lot of ice and debris that moves around. Cook Inlet actually has underwater sand waves that roll along its bottom in certain areas where our equipment will be operating. So it's definitely something to be mindful of. What we are expecting, though, the way that we've designed our system to work is that our bearings work with that silt to actually grind it up and make it kind of used as a bearing system for our device. I think the biggest system maintenance item that we'll have to look into is going to be some of those corrosion effects from both operating in a saltwater environment and the abrasion that happens from some of that silt. So in our case, that might be, you know, paint or galvanic resistant. That would be something we have to be looking into for the maintenance aspect. Beyond that, of course, we're still going through a deployment in Maine where we are anticipating to kind of address some of these hurdles up front before we get to the water in Cook Inlet, but absolutely looking to get our device operating in the system in Cook Inlet. And that what's interesting too, to that point, is that our preliminary permit through FERC doesn't allow us to actually put any power onto the local utility grid at this point in time. So it's a great time for us to kind of vet out some of these technicalities and see how the operations work. And then once we're at the end of this four-year permit, we can convert that into a pilot project permit where we can actually put out upwards of 5 megawatts onto the grid there. So that's the intention. Of course, there's a lot of concerns about operations with the device around beluga whales and salmon as well. So we're working with some of the regulators in that environment to make sure we're having a safe and appropriate project as we go forward.
And there's another question from Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, I was looking back on slide 18 and I'm wondering if we're listing Cook Inlet as one of the largest tidal energy resources in the world. Is that due to the kind of strength of these tides in Cook Inlet and the sort of volume? I know Cook Inlet has large tides. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit how tidal energy resources are sort of quantified?
Sure. So in this case, you're right. It is in regards to the flow. So in that, there's a little box on the top that is kilowatts per meter squared. So that's like a cross-sectional area of how much power runs through a small section of Cook Inlet. So in our case, what we're interested in for developing tidal energy is in regards to the flow. And so that's the velocity of the current that moves through the area. So Cook Inlet is known to have, you know, some areas go up to 8-10 knots. Especially by the East Foreland areas there. So there's quite a tremendous amount of velocity that comes through. And that's also why our system works in river environments too, because a lot of rivers kind of hit in that same higher velocity type flow scenario. There are different types of energy that kind of works in the ocean environment, which would be wave power. There's an interesting concept about some tidal power being used for the up and down action. It's fairly slow in terms of how fast that is actually produced, but in our case, we're specifically looking at the velocity of the tide. And so in Cook Inlet, you can see on this picture there, there's actually a choke point between the East and West Foreland over by Nikiski area, where it says Kenai on the map, where there's some black spots in the water there. And that is specifically because of the natural choke point that Cookinda creates this massive, tremendous amount of velocity that increases through that area. And that's particularly where we're looking at for our project development.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you as well.
Representative Wright, do you have a question?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So that's basically Pascali's law, right? The way it bottlenecks and it creates more force when it goes through this. So that's what's happening?
That's correct. Okay. Yep. If you think about it, it's actually a three-dimensional shape. You know, on that particular image, you only see the 2D of the land coming in. Right on the bottom of Cookinda as well, there's a choke-up point in some of those areas as well. So exactly correct. And we're restricting the amount of volume for a flow to go through in the same speed. It has to increase to make sure it goes through there in a faster manner.
And follow-up?
Go ahead, follow-up.
So what's the depth that you have to place one of these? Like, how deep do you need it to be? Is there a sweet spot? Or?
Certainly, yes. Yeah. So the rib gen and the modular rib gen system, those are kind of designed to go down to about 200 foot of water. Of course, most rivers aren't that deep, so we're, you know, hopefully not pulling one off the bottom of an area that particularly deep. In this case with Cook Inlet, our tide gen system, we're looking to operate in at least 100 feet of water. And so we need to find those areas that are 100 feet or deeper for our first system to operate reliably. Part of the reason for that is because on top of the amount of variability in the tidal height that happens at Cook Inlet, there's also the variability in the ice keel depth that happens at Cook Inlet. So we need to be about 10 to 15 feet below mean low tide to be able to avoid some of that debris and things like that as well. So definitely the deeper parts is what we're looking at. Actually, where our site is up in the Kiski is the kind of a deep channel that runs through there. There's also a similar deep channel on the west side of Cook Inlet as well. So those are definitely kind of the deeper spots we're looking for. Definitely not trying to find anything that's, you know, thousands of feet deep. We want to be able to have, you know, an appropriate mooring system that we can get to if we have to access it and things like that. And so that's why Cook Inlet is kind of an ideal location for some of that work.
Thank you.
Excellent question, by the way.
And I have a one more. Considering fish, salmon, in the inlet, as opposed to Igiabik, you could probably took videos, you've taken photos in Igiabik. I'm not sure you can do that in the Cook Inlet, and I'm wondering, will that have a bearing on how the fish interpret what's in the water? Obviously, they could see what was going on in the river, in my opinion, and I'm just guessing because I don't have the science behind it, but in the Cook Inlet, that's not going to be it's going to be a factor differently. Am I correct, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you know, in the way that, you know, species and marine species work, is a lot of it's based off of, you know, their echo finding abilities. So, like through mammals and things like that, and through fish, they use some similar electric sensing as well. But you're right. There's no real visibility, so to speak, in Cook Inlet to actually see an upcoming obstacle in that nature. And so what we'll be implementing is sonar systems to actually determine where fish species are, where whale species are, some listening systems as well to kind of listen for that environmental impact rather than looking for it. And so with our system in Igiabik, it was definitely a excellent location for monitoring fish with visual media through a camera. And that's definitely a net tactic we'll have to change up when we come into Cook Inlet here. But we're also hoping to replicate some of that data in other rivers in Alaska as well. So if you look at the Yukon or the Kuskokwim, both of those rivers are, you know, very muddy or silty and don't have the visibility that you would in the Kwechek River, which is off of the, you know, biggest lake in Alaska. So that's absolutely something we're going to be looking into in the coming years here.
All right. Thank you very much. If you will, any more questions? Other committee members, no. Please continue again, Mr. Chukansky.
Thank you. We can go ahead and skip ahead two slides, I believe, to slide 20.
Yep.
So we have an active project in Port McKenzie, Alaska. We've been working with Matsu Borough on this project for about over a year now. This is a phase one SBIR project, which is focused on finding a secondary use case for our system rather than going straight into a grid. And so in this case, we focused on producing what's coined as an electrofuel. So it would be something like ammonia or hydrogen or a biodiesel. And in our case, we just chose to focus on hydrogen because of the way that those systems work. So This is a project that we're actually going to be applying for a phase two portion with, hopefully be able to purchase some equipment, get a demonstration project operating, and see how that system can work within Cook Inlet and also have some kind of meaningful byproduct. As I mentioned before, with FERC, I know there is a four-year limit where we can't put power on the grid. And Chair, if you don't mind, I realize it's up against the hour. Is there a need to stop at this point in time?
Pardon me?
Is there a need to stop at this point in time, or would you like to continue going forward?
No, you're fine.
Okay. Next slide, please. So our system that was kind of shown previously is also called the Tygen 20. This is a very small scale system. It's only a 20 kilowatt device. This is kind of going in the water in Maine for the demonstration project. And we had the anticipation to bring this system to Alaska and redeploy it in Cook Inlet for our initial testing purposes. So as you can see, the turbine is the same type of turbine, same kind of platform it sits on. The only difference is actually the deployment system. So in this case, this is a neutrally buoyant system that would hold the system basically mid-water column, so it can operate through the tidal cycle. Hmm. And then I wanted to give a quick overview on some of the things that are happening internationally. So next slide, please. There's a concept called a ring fence that's been being used in other different areas to kind of bring some of those renewables to bear on a larger scale. Next slide, please. And looking at some of these locations and where they've operated and been successful, particularly in the UK, what it's done is it's allowed some of these renewable industries to really get a foothold and grow. If we go to the next slide again, as an example with some numbers behind it, the United Kingdom actually implemented a ring fence concept for wind turbines where they, I think it was in 2007, set up a basically a preferential rate for wind turbine developers to sell electricity at an above market price. And that basically shoehorned a lot of development to happen in the UK. And now they're one of the leaders in offshore wind, makes up 25% of their grid. So it's a very interesting concept that they put together for that. We have a similar thing we're doing in the state of Maine. We have a power purchase agreement where we've negotiated a above market price for that. And also Nova Scotia, they have what's called a feed-in tariff. And what our competitors are doing is in North Scotland and Wales area is that there's actually the development of the fourth now ring fence concept where tidal industry is being incentivized to produce in that location. Next slide, please. And so what we did just kind of as an exercise and just to bring up this conversation piece is to think about what if we did that in an area like Alaska or in Cook Inlet where we could have some sort of set aside for preferential rates for this tidal energy. And what would that do? The first thing is that it could potentially attract more developers to Alaska and bring some folks up here that want to leverage and take advantage of that. And so, you know, for the tidal industry, of course, I'm with ORPC, but you can't have an industry with just one player. You need the whole marketplace to cooperate as well. But what that would do is it would potentially allow some of these developers to bring their operations to Alaska, incentivize them to operate in the state, and bring some of those manufacturing jobs to the state of Alaska as well. And so, you know, there's potentially ways to do this through federal or state funding. Definitely a discussion to have at another time, but I wanted to bring that up as kind of an idea and something that's happening in the tidal industry on a global scale right now as well. So just something to chew on for the minute. and the next slide, and that is my last slide that I had, so happy to field any more questions or whatever else you may have at the moment. So thank you, Chair.
Any of the committee members have a question for Mr. Jakinski? No? Well, I like it. I appreciate the presentation. I think it's very interesting. I don't quite comprehend all the maintenance that's involved and how it happens, but I think it's an amazing ability to utilize the tides like we do and in this state and like you're trying to do in other places in the state. So appreciate the presentation. I appreciate the information that you've brought forward. Representative Cox, you have a statement or a question?
A question through the chair. Are you working with the Alaska Energy Authority or any other state agency?
Yes, we are. We are working We actually update Alaska Energy Authority on a regular basis. We also work with DNR for some of our permitting and regulatory pathways there. Work with ADA as well in their, some of that capacity and bring some of these concepts up with them in the, in a lot of our projects. We've actually had, I think, one funded project through AEA in the past. And part of what we're trying now is to kind of push that commercial aspect for where we're at with things.
Can I follow up?
Yes, there's another smaller company, I guess, working out of, or were working out of Fairbanks. Are you familiar with their work at all?
Yeah, so there's a couple different developers in the state. I know ASAP was working on the Tanana River with, I think it's Blade Runner, and there's also another one called Waterhorse. And so those are different developers for some of the river aspects. ORPC, actually, originally before I was with ORPC, helped develop that river site on the Tanana by Fairbanks. And so it's definitely something that we've had our hand in terms of the development of the industry for the state.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else have a question for Mr. Jakinski? Well, Mr. Jakinski, thank you very much for your presentation, and I appreciate you being available for us. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
So I'd like to thank everybody for your indulgence today. I know we have some subcommittees on the way today that everybody has to get to. So the next meeting will be Thursday, March 9th, 11 a.m. Having no further business before the committee, we are adjourned at 11:05.